Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-372, United States of America, Mr. Cecil L. P. and L. Appellants. Mr. Robbins for the appellant, Ms. Nyland for the athlete.
May it please the court, I'm Larry Robbins representing the appellants this morning. Our central submission this morning, Your Honors, is that when the government seizes and restrains the assets of an indicted defendant, it should be required to establish at a pretrial hearing that it had a probable cause basis for doing so. Now, there's a threshold challenge this morning to appealability, but unless the court has jurisdictional questions, I don't propose to address that issue. Suffice it to say that every single court of appeals to have addressed that question has sustained interlocutory appellate jurisdiction either under 1292A1 or under the collateral order doctrine, and I submit that we have addressed the government's quarrels with that in our brief, and I propose, unless the court has questions on jurisdiction, to turn to the merits. And on the merits, I think it's important to see at the outset that the government concedes two important propositions that frame the issue rather well for us. First, they concede that an indicted defendant does have a right to some kind of pretrial hearing on due process grounds when the government seizes his assets. And second, they concede that at that hearing, the indicted defendant can at least challenge the issue of traceability of the assets, whether the assets seized derived from the alleged illegal conduct. So the remaining question is whether at that hearing the defendant may also challenge the question whether the seizure application stated probable cause. At the government's urging, Judge Collier concluded that a defendant, as a matter of law, simply may not challenge probable cause. In the court's view, to permit that would be, in effect, to look behind the indictment, and that would be impermissible. We believe
that your entire attack on probable cause in this case, based on the applicability, based on the statutory question, and whether you're within the, whether the alleged conduct comes within the statute.
I think our central argument, Judge Santel, is precisely that. This seizure was effected under one statute.
Why didn't you raise that in a motion to dismiss?
If the
indictment doesn't state a defense for statutory reasons, an offense for statutory reasons, why isn't that determinable in a motion to dismiss?
Well, in fairness, it is determinable in a motion to dismiss, but
why
I don't.
Why are we going through all this?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First off,
if you have that hearing and win, not only do you get your stuff back, you're out of the woods.
Yes,
if
but
if you have that hearing and lose, then you've lost on the only issue you've got. So why are we going through all this?
Well, first of all, there's a general matter, Your Honor, as you know, a motion addressed to an indictment must be addressed to the face of the indictment, and an indictment, of course, need only track the statute. So in the general run of cases,
did you seek a bill of particulars?
I'm not in the trial case, so I can't say.
Well, when I say you, I'm speaking of your side of the case. Actually, the defendant is the one who would be
right.
Usually the subject of the sentence, but did the defense here seek a bill of particulars?
To my knowledge,
if they had sought and obtained a bill of particulars, why would not everything concerning the statutory compass that you're raising or attempting to raise in this proceeding be within the scope of the motion to dismiss after the bill of particulars?
Well, I would suggest, first of all, the answer to your question, I am informed by trial counsel, is that they have not yet sought a bill.
I saw them shake their heads when you
yes.
were out there.
Yes, right.
I assume they knew what they were shaking about.
Well, I turn to them because I'm not trying the case at this point, Your Honor. No, they have not sought yet a bill of particulars, but I don't think that's an adequate remedy for due process purposes.
That's what I'm asking you. Why would it not be in
well,
this case? Now, you know, we don't just decide general principles. We have cases in front of us, and in this case, it seemed to me the whole attack was on whether the money protection statute actually covered the conduct in question here, and I don't see why that couldn't be raised without us getting to this constitutional question here.
Well, there are several answers, and if I might, the first is that as a general proposition, a motion to dismiss the indictment is must be and is invariably based on the face of the indictment, and therefore
we've been over that.
Right, but and I don't think
a particular you could have raised the question.
I don't think a bill of particulars solves that problem, but more fundamentally, Judge, a motion to dismiss may be resolved well into the life of the case. And in all of that period of time, while the defendants wait for the disposition of that motion.
How long have you been waiting on this one, counsel?
Well, this was done on an expedited basis. We've moved very quickly. And this is the time when defendants are entitled to the lawyer of their choice during this investigative period, and all during this period of time, they are deprived of property that may be the very lifeblood of the businesses, which may fail as a consequence.
As a general rule, is there any reason to think that proceedings on a motion to dismiss the indictment would take longer than the hearing you propose?
I don't know, Judge Williams, whether I could generalize about that. I can say this, though. As a general proposition, a pretrial post-seizure hearing is likely to be scheduled earlier than a motion to dismiss the indictment, because it is frequently the case that the motion calendar in a trial will be set later in the life of the case, whereas as soon as the seizure takes place, you can begin the process of getting your hearing right off the bat, which is what these clients sought. And the fact of the matter is, once the government takes your property, I can't think of a good reason why the defendants who need this property to hire their lawyers of choice ought to have to wait, and by the way, use lawyers they didn't choose to then move to dismiss the indictment.
The defendant's argument is basically that your argument is that you start with the property. The government's argument is it's not really your property because of the crimes that it alleges have been committed. And you say, essentially, they've got to show probable cause, to which the government's answer is, we did it. We secured an indictment. And it does seem to me you have to, I guess there are sort of two things. You have to explain why, as a general matter, the indictment isn't enough, and as a more particular matter, you have to distinguish between the government seizing the body of the defendant on the basis of the indictment versus seizing his property.
Well, let me address both. First off, they got an indictment that, by the way, Judge Williams, asserts not only probable cause as to the offense, but probable cause to then forfeit the assets, yet they concede we can challenge the latter.
Well, that it's an inconsistency, I think, is clear.
But it's an inconsistency that goes to the integrity of that argument, because the notion that we can challenge, look behind the indictment for one purpose but not another, is quite odd, and by the way, is an anomalous argument in our criminal justice system, because the fact is, we have all manner of proceedings that look behind the indictment that aren't the trial on the merits. For example, Your Honor referred to the seizure of the body. Well, criminal defendants get a detention hearing, and they can challenge the probable cause to be detained. That's looking behind the indictment.
My recollection, that's been a long time since I was a trial judge, a prosecutor, and a defense attorney, was that your probable cause at the detention hearing was established where an indictment had been returned.
Well, you've
got a probable cause hearing if you're arrested on a warrant or an information, but on an indictment, probable cause is established.
My recollection from my prosecutor's days is that we had all manner of hearings about detention. But the point I was going to make.
I don't recall ever hearing of probable cause being tested at a detention hearing where the arrest was on an indictment.
But all right. But how about a suppression hearing, Your Honor? A suppression hearing.
That's to suppress whether there's probable cause for the issuance of a search warrant or a search.
It doesn't go
behind the indictment.
But in effect it does, because what we are challenging, Judge Sentell, is the sufficiency of an application for a seizure that professed to assert probable cause. That may very well, in the run of cases, replicate the probable cause stated in indictment. But we are challenging the application. Now, the fact that the government alleges the same set of facts in both the indictment and the application may be a choice they wish to make, but it doesn't mean that we are looking behind the indictment. We are looking not behind the indictment, but at the application. And when the government files an application and says, we are taking your assets that you may want to hire lawyers of your choice, it doesn't seem to me to be an appropriate application of Matthews against Eldridge to say.
Can I ask you on the Matthews against Eldridge question, is that any different whether or not they have other assets to hire counsel?
Well,
it seems to me the due process question, well known, is the same without regard to the Sixth Amendment question.
Well, I agree with that, Your Honor. My view is that due process is not simply for the destitute. And so as an original matter, I don't share the view that the government asserts that Matthews against Eldridge is only triggered in our favor if, as an initial matter, we don't have the assets to hire other counsel. And by the way, lest there be no question about that, this case comes to this court with no finding that the defendants have other resources. There is a suggestion that there was some language in the stay opinion of the district court regarding the access to funds, but the case that comes before this court has no finding in that regard.
You are asserting that as a backup position, though, right? You're not saying all or nothing.
Yes.
Your primary submission is that you get the hearing either way. Your backup position is if you do a showing that you need it for attorney's fees.
Precisely, Judge Kavanaugh.
On the suppression hearing, that's clearly distinguishable, isn't it? Because that's saying that something behind the indictment, independent of what the grand jury would have seen, created an illegality, right?
Well, no, I don't think so, Judge Williams. In a standard search warrant, there'll be an assertion of illegality.
Search warrant's not endorsed by the grand jury.
Right.
No, but this application for a seizure wasn't either. This is an application,
no, but the application
to a magistrate.
For a seizure, insofar as it depends on the commission of the crime, does depend on the indictment.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite.
The application for the seizure, insofar as it depends on the commission of the crime, does depend on the indictment.
But it independently asserted that these were crimes. It independently asserted that there was a violation of.
I don't understand what you mean by independently asserted. Didn't it say in it there'd been an indictment returned to that effect, or?
Well, I'm sorry, but the application, which is reproduced in Joint Appendix 259 et sec, makes representations on its face regarding 1960, the elements of 1960, the violation of 1960, and asserts that 1960 has been violated. While it may well be true, Your Honor, that the indictment does the same, what we are here challenging is the sufficiency of this document. In fact, the application in support of the seizure warrant begins by invoking the very statutes that it purports to be.
Now, let me make sure I've got one other thing straight. Insofar as if you win here and you get a probable cause hearing, my reading of your filings is the only thing you're going to be attacking is the applicability of the statute to the business involved here, that you're not really disputing the evidence or the strength of the evidence. A pure legal question is all you want to raise. Is that correct?
I think, Judge Sentell, that is essentially correct with one slight tweak.
All right, give me the tweak.
The tweak is that, assuming our view of the law is correct, that the facts alleged in the application do not meet the statute as properly construed.
I think that's not a tweak. That's a restatement of my proposition.
Then we're in
so
agreement.
There's nothing to hear on an evidentiary basis. You're conceding the government's evidence is what it is.
Right.
It's only a matter of law that you want to argue.
All the more reason to allow the defendants to get an early hearing on that proposition.
You're not arguing traceability?
Well, I think the government concedes that we can.
Okay.
And I don't think we're forfeiting the right to do so, but I do want to say this. offering us the right to argue traceability in a 1960 case is rather like bringing the proverbial milk calls to Newcastle.
I understand, but just as a formal and technical matter, I want to understand, like Judge Santel, what exactly would be before the district court in a hearing.
I think that the main proposition is the purely legal question of whether 1960 applies. The government has conceded that if we have traceability arguments, we can make them at that time. But I think that the answer to His Honor's question is yes. The main argument is on the application of 1960. I see that my time is dwindling, and I've reserved the balance for rebuttal, if I might.
We don't actually have any balance. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Jim. Hear from the government.
Good morning. Suzanne Nyland for the United States. I'd like to turn first to the merits in order to respond directly to the argument raised by counsel and then address the jurisdictional issue second, if I may, in this circumstance. Clearly, the appellants below had a hearing before Judge Collier at which they were given the opportunity to demonstrate two things. One, that they absolutely needed these particular assets in order to have counsel of choice. And
she didn't rule on that issue.
Well, she did ultimately rule on the issue in the context of the motion for stay.
You revoked the ruling on the stay.
She did, but she was relying on the submissions that they actually placed before her in the context of this hearing. And that was one of the issues that could have been addressed to that hearing. Appellants did not address it at the hearing she provided them. They simply relied on their submissions, the financial affidavits back and forth about what assets they had, what assets they needed. So I think it's fair to say, although we've been clear to say that she made that decision in the context of whether there'd be irreparable harm, that the basic factual finding is they have $3.8 million worth of assets still available to them for whatever purpose. This finding was made based looking at all of the affidavits that have been put forth by the parties in connection with the evidentiary hearing they were offered, and they did not supplement that. So it's our view that having made that finding, the district court already provided them with due process, and that provides essentially the ground on which the district court's order
now,
can be affirmed.
What finding is it that you say provided them with due process?
What provided them with due process was the opportunity to show that they need these assets. They had to show that, and they had to show the second issue, which they've conceded, which is the assets, if one accepts the allegations set forth in the indictment or in the seizure warrant, are forfeitable.
They have not conceded that the assets are forfeitable. They've not even conceded that a crime's been committed.
They've certainly not conceded that, and I understand that. Let me find a better phrase for it. They've not asserted that the traceability, we'll call it the traceability issue or the involvement issue. They've certainly not contested that. What they want to do is attack the indictment.
Yes.
And as the court is focused on in their part of the argument, Judge Collier below also invited them to file a motion to dismiss if, in fact, there was a straight-up legal issue that she could handle.
Forgetting for the moment the motion to dismiss, if counsel is correct, and at least has a decent argument, that the Sixth Amendment issue and the due process issues are several, that is to say you don't have to be destitute to be afforded due process before your property is seized, what due process did they have with the question of the seizability?
On the seizability, they had the opportunity to show that these were so-called innocent assets, assets from, say, a business completely uninvolved in
did
that.
Did they have a chance to show, you would say they did have a chance to show traceability?
Yes, they did, and they conceded.
Did they have a chance to show that your probable cause, that there was no probable cause present to believe that a crime had been committed or that this?
No, they did not. But that is what the trial is for, and I have
no,
to.
No, that's not what trial is for.
No, and let me explain.
Trial is not a probable cause. Now, counsel, don't.
No, but that's. Let me expound on that answer, because what they're trying to get here is a mini trial of the ultimate issue in the case.
Well, in fact, they aren't at all.
That doesn't answer anything.
They're not asking for that at all. They're asking for a showing of probable cause. And in this particular case, they're asking for it only with respect to a legal issue. So what you say is just completely
Well, in fact, the record
inaccurate.
Reflects it's not just for a legal issue, and that may be why we haven't
certainly
seen this motion filed yet.
It's the claim they're making here.
They haven't yet filed it, though. And I would respectfully submit to the court that the problem below, and this is reflected in the hearing that they had, where they had the opportunity to address the issues I've already touched on, to come in and make some kind of showing on this point, and there was a discussion there as to whether or not there would be a factual dispute involved if they filed a motion to dismiss. And the government said if their 1960 argument, the merits of which I'm not prepared to go into here, involves the allegation, if we didn't accept cash, we're not a money transmittal organization, that's a factual issue. That's a legal defense they're going to want to raise at trial.
Not the way you stated it. You just stated their allegation is if we didn't accept cash, then we're not a money.
That's my understanding of the issue they want to test.
Once you put that if in, there's not a fact question in there.
Well, if there is, yes, but if there is a factual dispute about that, then how's that going to be resolved?
If there is a factual dispute, but I don't understand the government to be asserting they took cash or them to be asserting that the government doesn't have evidence or whatever it says.
Well, in fact, the prosecutor did state for the record we would not concede that issue below, that that would be a factual issue that would be disputed if that was going to be the basis of their motion to dismiss.
Therefore, then, why aren't they entitled to a probable cause hearing on that factual issue before you take their property?
Because what's at issue here is whether due process, what's at issue here is the assets that have been seized, not their entire legal defense.
What the issue here is the seizure of the assets.
That, yes, and of these particular assets.
Seizing people's assets. It has to have a legal basis to do so. And normally it would have to afford people due process before it did so.
And they have been afforded due process.
What was their due process?
Their due process is that they had the opportunity to show these assets had nothing to do with the allegations that are in the complaint. And
let me just, if you continue to be so stubborn, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, you've got the burden over on them. That's not where it belongs. The government can't go take my car and say, you can get it back if you can prove it was never used in any crimes. You have to have some reason shown to the court why you make a seizure.
Right,
getting
in this case.
Because, well, they had the chance to prove themselves innocent. Wouldn't help you in a trial,
I'm not claiming that.
Which they didn't have. They didn't have a chance to prove themselves innocent. All that had a chance to prove was that the assets could not be traced to the factual events alleged by the government.
Right. But recalling that we did make a showing to the court, there was a probable cause finding made by the court here. The government did not simply take this property.
Probable cause about what?
In probable cause to support the seizure warrant, there was an affidavit submitted ex parte to the district court on that.
Not with respect to the crime.
Yes,
could
that's
you focus
what
on that? The crime is central to the seizure. Yeah. And for some reason or other, you won't talk about that.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't understand. So I am trying to talk about that. And the point is that what they're looking for here is a mini trial to.
On the commission of the crime.
They have not had a hearing on the commission.
That's
of the
what
crime.
I thought.
There's been an indictment. Let's go to the indictment.
And I raised earlier the question of the difference between the property and the person of the defendant. Now, it seems to me there's something of an answer there, and that is that there's a presumption in favor of bail, and the when a person's person is seized. They at least have substantial chance of getting out. Now, that appears not to be the case with respect to property. Now it is true, as far as I can make out, that in the bail hearing there's no direct requirement that the government show probable cause. On the other hand, at least if the Second Circuit in Monsanto 4 can be credited, it sounds plausible, in a bail hearing, the strength of the government's evidence comes in at least as a factor bearing on the probability of an attempt to escape. So, then you get your person out by posting a bond, so that the impact on the person is considerably less drastic than what the government proposes here to rest on the indictment with respect to property.
But to take that analogy of a detention hearing, the focus at a detention hearing, ordinarily, where the probable cause from the indictment is accepted as establishing probable cause and not relitigated, is the focus on the flight risk or the danger to the community. I would say the analogy here is the focus is on, are these assets forfeitable? Are they innocent assets?
No,
are they not traceable?
No, that's different. Because in connection with bail, the question is whether the defendant is going to abscond, right? At least I haven't heard the government defend this seizure in terms of the risk that if the defendants are allowed access to the property, they're going to make off with it. And maybe the government is making such a contention, but I didn't see it in the brief.
the government isn't obliged to make that, well, in the decision, factually,
I'm trying to get you to consider the analogy between person and property. So could you focus on that?
Yes, sir.
Well, could you, the Supreme Court in Monsanto 3 says it would be anomalous if there were more protection for property than for the person. Probably so. But it appears that on the government's view as to seizure of property and the established law on freedom of the person, there is considerably less protection with respect to property than there is for the person.
Well, the situations are different. Due process is flexible depending on the individual
circumstances. Okay, explain the relevant distinctions.
Well, I guess to go back to the detention hearing, I don't know why we would be opening up the door and providing more. I think what you're proposing here is more protection for property than you would for the person.
No, because you'd
be litigating the issue of probable cause all the way to the point of bringing in witnesses to talk about whether or not they've accepted cash or not
which is an ultimate issue for trial. All the way to bringing in. I don't understand that.
Well, because it is, and that's reflected in the hearing transcript below. And in fact, that's been the reason why they haven't been able to get this issue dealt with in the civil forfeiture case that preceded this one. The court said, I can't resolve this on a motion to dismiss in the civil context because it's fact-bound and it's got to wait for trial. That's the issue they want to get litigated
The government in that case asserted that cash was transferred?
In that case, they filed a motion for, I'm not sure if we said that to answer your question, they filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And this is in the first civil forfeiture case that preceded either this one or the criminal case. And Judge Collier said, that's fact-bound, and it's so fact-bound, I can't decide that on the pleadings. So I just want to alert the court, it is not as simple as
represented
here.
But what fact is disputed?
Well, they're disputing it today, that's true. I just wanted to alert the court that it's not as simple as it sounds.
Let's actually focus on their particular claim. Which actually is, we'll assume no facts until the government alleges that that cash was involved. We want a ruling on the legal issue.
How is that
giving more protection than would be given in a bail hearing?
Because they've already got another avenue for that, for due process. They can, in fact, as the court's already discussed, file a motion to dismiss. It doesn't have to be done in this context, where possibly there would have to be some sort of factual.
You know, Justice Douglas used to say, we don't write for today only.
Right.
Should we be establishing a precedent? Maybe we wouldn't have to. But should we be establishing a precedent that the government can execute these seizures without affording Matthews v. Eldridge that due process?
No, we agree that Matthews v. Eldridge does apply. We have always said they're entitled to a hearing.
Matthews v. Eldridge hearing into the probable cause in this case.
That's where we disagree with respect, and we point to Farmer and Jones and other courts that have taken the position that the central issue at this point, this question, due process is the essence.
You just completely missed my question, then. Where did they get a Matthews v. Eldridge type due process in this case? Then you started to tell me that's where we disagree. You can't disagree with a question. You have to answer a question.
Where did they get it?
Yeah.
They got it when they were asked to show two things, neither of which they showed.
No. Matthews v. Eldridge requires you to show things. You're putting the burden over on them.
Actually, it's...
How did the government show probable cause to seize their property?
Actually, I have to respectfully disagree. Matthews v. Eldridge, as a first proposition, requires the defendant to come in and say, here is the interest that's at stake that I need a hearing.
They've shown the interest.
Well, with due respect, I don't think they have.
$3.5 billion is not an interest.
But that's not sufficient. Let me just alert the court that, as far as I know, there's been no case, other than cases touching on real property, that say it doesn't matter whether he's destitute or not. Though all of these cases are very, and if you look at even the Monsanto Second Circuit decision,
right,
says it's not enough
assume
to simply
the
say
destitution.
That.
Destitution. Where did they get a chance to show anything else in this? Where did they get Matthews v. Eldridge due process?
Well, this is where we disagree. Some
no, you can't disagree with the question.
Where did
the
they get it? They had
is,
the opportunity to show the
essence. Where did they get a chance, a Matthews v. Eldridge due process on the question of probable cause? Don't tell me you
they
disagree.
Didn't. I agree that they did not get a proper chance to do that.
Quit starting to talk while I'm still asking the question. I didn't even hear the beginning of your answer. Go back and start over.
As I've stated, they did not get a hearing on probable cause. I completely concede that.
Bingo.
And it's our position they're not entitled to one.
And your position is that we shouldn't follow the Second Circuit, right?
That's right.
And has the government had problems in the last decade in the Second Circuit on this issue?
I was unable to check, I was unable to find any case that would look like this one, where you'd essentially be litigating.
You would think this happens all the time in the Second Circuit, no doubt, under the Monsanto standard.
Right.
Government hasn't made any case that that somehow hindered its law enforcement efforts.
No, it hasn't. But this case is unusual in a lot of respects. And one of those respects is that essentially this is...
Well, this case may be unusual, but as Judge Sentell said, the rule we established will be applying
right.
to a lot of different cases. And my question is whether somehow there's been some problem in achieving law enforcement objectives in the Second Circuit, and there's been no assertion to that effect by the government.
I can't answer that question. I can't point to one. But I would like to just briefly, because I have just seconds left, touch on the jurisdictional issue. In this particular case, because it's a seizure warrant and because it's tethered to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel of choice, they can actually raise this issue and litigate it before this court when the criminal case has been decided, at which point there will have been a full airing of whatever their defense is that they want to test.
The seizure issue, when you say they can litigate this at the end of the proceeding, you would not concede that the government would have to pay them for the deprivation of property in the meantime, would you?
No, I would not, but I
right,
would...
So how can they litigate the present pretrial seizure of their property after trial?
They can raise it if they're going to take an appeal from a final criminal judgment.
How can they get full recompense at the conclusion of trial? It's not good enough so you can raise it after trial, or you would never have any interlocutory appeals. Any issue could be raised after trial.
That's right. And they may come back again and again with interlocutory appeals. It's what they proposed to do here.
Whoa. I'm not hearing you. I realize I'm hard of hearing, but it's also hard for anybody to hear when you're talking while I'm talking. So start that answer over, please.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. My understanding is that one cannot raise an interlocutory appeal when one's counsel's been disqualified in the middle of a case. So it's our argument that simply not having the assets to hire counsel of choice wouldn't give one a greater right.
Well, how about just the deprivation of one's property?
But because in concept, this property is already the government's from the moment the trial has been.
But probable cause has not been shown.
It has been shown to the judge. The judge made a probable cause finding.
No, please don't go back to that.
She made the ex parte finding.
Please don't go back to that.
All right, I'm sorry. That is the answer. There hasn't been an
adversary
finding, yes.
Probable cause that they committed the crime, which is an essential ingredient, has not been shown except through the indictment.
And there was a separate submission. Yes, this in the separate civil case, there was a submission made to the judge ex parte. Ex parte. There was not an adversary hearing.
That's your problem.
But
ex parte doesn't count.
Right.
Matthews v. Eldridge. No case recognizes ex parte
right.
as final due process.
But I'm not aware of any case, even under Matthews v. Eldridge, that would give them the hearing they seek when they haven't even made the threshold showing that they need these particular seized assets in order to pay for counsel.
Well, why does it?
You said yourself, there's lots of cases on deprivation of property. Granted, they generally occur in real property context, but there's lots of cases on deprivation of property. So you get a post-seizure due process, Matthews v. Eldridge, that process.
Not without making
we wouldn't have any cases
showing.
If, counsel, we wouldn't have any cases if we didn't have that. I mean, that's where the cases arise.
Not
under this statute, but due process.
And not based on this kind of claim.
Pardon?
Not based on this kind of claim for counsel fees to pay.
Forget about counsel fees. We're talking about due process for seizing people's property.
And actually, a number of those cases don't even cite Matthews v. Eldridge, which goes to show why they're real dangerous to
rely on. Matthews v. Eldridge have anything to do with counsel fees?
Matthews v. Eldridge itself? No.
No. Granted. So now we're talking about due process, just like Matthews v. Eldridge was. So don't give us that stuff about there not being cases on people having a right to post-seizure due process when it was done on some ex parte basis.
Most of those cases involve the government not justifying why it took the particular assets. They are traceability cases. They are not cases that look like this, and that is why none of them would support that outcome in this case.
On appealability, Mr. Robbins is correct, isn't he, that every court of appeals has allowed an interlocutory appeal in this situation?
No. In fact, that's exactly not correct. Only in the instance where the underlying instrument was an injunction, where it's injunction jurisdiction, where it's been a restraining order that's at issue.
He points to language in the seizure order, which certainly looks like injunctive language to me.
No, because I understand that argument. The problem, however, is that anytime the government takes property through a seizure warrant, let's say they go to a bank and ask a bank officer, take the following steps to give the government control over this particular account so that it won't be dissipated because it's the proceeds of criminal action. That doesn't necessarily convert it into something that is in the nature of an injunction or a restraining order. In this case,
this was titled restraining order in part.
But they didn't actually, if you look through all of their pleadings, nowhere in their pleadings do they say, because of the restraining order, we are unable to have funds to hire counsel. There's no factual findings.
You agree that it was entitled restraining order in part?
It is. It's in the title.
And a restraining order is appealable.
Restraining order is appealable, and he's absolutely right.
And this was entitled restraining order.
But that's not what they're litigating here. They're litigating the seizure warrant. The fight here is over.
That's what you're litigating when you say they don't have a right to the interlocutory appeal.
That's right.
Don't tell me they're not litigating. You're the one who raised that question about the appealability.
That's right, because there's not a single paragraph in any of their pleadings below, or for that matter in this case, that discusses why the terms of the restraining order are a problem. It is completely and solely focused on the $1.5 million in assets that were taken with the seizure warrant.
If the seizure warrant is dissolved, does the restraining order go with it?
I would say not, because they've not raised any issues for this court to address with regard to the restraining order. In any event, for the reasons set forth in our brief, and because they've already had a hearing.
They raise goes the dissolution of all the restraint. If they win on the seizability of these assets, that restraint's not in effect.
It's a separate legal question.
Their money, and they can do what they want to at that point, right?
But the restraining order has different it has a different scope. It has nothing to do with the $1.5 million in assets that they want to get back in order to hire their attorneys. It's a completely different document.
What's it about?
That's my point. What's in it is if they want to sell some of the, for instance, precious metals that are supposedly backing up Eagle, they have to inform the government with X number of days of notice, those sorts of constraints on their day-to-day businesses. And they've not talked about that in any of their briefs. That was never part of what was presented to the court other than simply in the title of their pleadings.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes for a vote.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just touch very quickly on that. If we're right on 1960, and show the absence of probable cause, then everything will dissolve, including the restraining order, and we would have no future injunctive obligations.
The counsel's contention is that there's nothing, as I understand it, that there's nothing restraining, nothing injunction-like about the actual seizure of the $1.5 million.
Well, actually, I don't think that's correct, because even the seizure warrant had injunctive provisions. It required, for example, the defendants to liquidate the E-Gold positions, turn them into cash, to give them to the government, convert them from one form to another. So it actually had an injunctive-like provisions. But in any event, it was tied to the restraining order. They all hang and fall together. By the way, even if we were wrong on 1292A, the two cases referred to in the government's argument, Jones and Farmer from the Fourth and Tenth Circuits, both you invoke the collateral order doctrine, so one way or the other, every circuit has come out our way.
Could I ask you about the issue of how much money the defendants have left? There is a finding by the district judge connected to the stay, which
yes.
occurs after the order under review. But I guess it's there. Is it implicitly your contention that that's clearly erroneous?
No. I wouldn't wish to be heard to be addressing that on the merits today. Although, Judge Williams, it's terribly important to know that since that stay denial, the district court has now appointed counsel.
Yes.
And a magistrate Kay has made findings sufficient to appoint counsel under the Criminal Justice Act. So I think whatever gravitas these stay remarks have, I think has been overtaken by events. But I'm not here arguing that, because at Joint Appendix 374 to 376, the court could not have been clearer that this question was not germane to the holding that brings this case to this court. She said, without regard to whether you can afford counsel or not, you simply may not challenge the probable cause in this kind of a proceeding.
So is your position that you don't have to make a showing with respect to fees first, has some logical force, but no other courts accepted that, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Respectfully, I'm not sure any litigant has made the argument that even if we can afford counsel, we should be able to, for example, afford better counsel.
Right.
More expensive counsel.
So your argument's really a pure property argument, at least your lead argument.
Yes.
And your backup argument's a counsel.
Precisely. I think we ought to win without regard to the Sixth Amendment fallback position Your Honor adverted to earlier. Let me just make one last point, and that is with regard to the analogy, Judge Williams, you were driving at before between the seizure of the body and the seizure of the property. I'd like to suggest a different and respectfully, I think, closer analogy, and that is to the suppression hearings. Suppression hearings challenge probable cause every day. The question is
probable cause with respect to the
seizure. An affidavit for a search warrant.
Right, right.
And they say, did the affidavit sufficiently challenge probable cause? Many times, in a high percentage of those cases, the allegations of probable cause dovetail with what's in the indictment. So too here. The allegations in the application for this seizure happen to dovetail in some ways verbatim with allegations that happen to also be in the indictment. But just as you can challenge probable cause for the search warrant because you're alleging that the affidavit for the search was insufficient, so too here we are saying that the application for the seizure was insufficient. It happens to be the case that they then recapitulate those same allegations in the indictment in both settings. But just as we can challenge a search warrant sufficiency, so too a seizure warrant's sufficiency. And the fact that it happens to, in some sense, look behind the indictment, I think misses the point. The government elected to restate those allegations, either in one case to seize property, in one case, seize property.
What if you're talking about an arrest warrant, though? An arrest warrant issued on an indictment which replicated the claims of the indictment. The defendant wouldn't get a probable cause hearing just because of that dovetailing.
Typically not, but again, in a bail proceeding where there's risk of flight, the government will talk about the strength of the evidence. The defense can come back and say, well, you know, magistrate judge, the evidence is actually not that strong because there's a legal problem with the very foundation of this case. And here's our legal argument. And I'm not so sure that a magistrate in adjudicating risk of flight couldn't, in that sense, look behind the indictment, which I
yes.
think is a,
no,
is
I,
a
I think
strange
that's correct.
And misleading.
That's
that
correct.
Would be for bail only.
Yes.
And even if you get bail, you've still got a seizure of the person because you have a restraint on the
correct.
Person's freedom. And you could not go behind the indictment to effect a complete freedom from the restraint on your liberty.
I think that's correct, but I continue to believe that when the government chooses to seize property, whether in a search warrant or whether in a seizure warrant, the right is the same. Did the government establish its authority to take your property?
We're not quite come to the question that I might have thought the case was about from either side, and that is whether the grand jury's finding of probable cause, and that we've all been asking questions based on the proposition, is the grand jury's finding of probable cause sufficient or not to support the seizure of property?
I think that a grand jury finding in which the defense doesn't even get to enter the room, much less make an argument, cannot possibly satisfy Matthews against
it's enough for arrest.
It's enough for arrest.
Enough to affect the liberty of the person.
To be sure. But it's not enough to do what they're doing here. We ought to get our day in court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Call the next case.